Okay, so in chapter 18, we spoke about the fact that Abraham was at a place mentioned a handful of times in the book called the Oaks of Mamre. Mamre was a person. The more familiar place name would be Hebron or Hebron. This is a place where Abraham had pitched his tent and a place of promise and assurance at numerous places along the way. God had promised that he would have descendants like the stars. He had promised that those descendants would possess the land. It's a place from which God had led him, Abraham, to victory. At that time, he was called Abram, in defeating great kings and rescuing his nephew Lot. He's now been promised in chapter 18 a son through Sarah named Isaac. In chapter 18 and verse 19, we touched on this verse, and I want to go back and just emphasize it for just a moment, because in this verse 18:19, we receive some further insight into Abraham's particular role, his specific role in God's plan, how it is that he would help to bring about the fulfillment of all of these great and wonderful promises. Well, what part would he play besides simply being the biological ancestor of Isaac, etc.? Well, the promises, of course, would not come to fruition in his lifetime. God had already told him that back in chapter 15. But in 18:19, we see that important to the fulfillment of these promises was a task that God was counting on Abraham to fulfill, namely, and you'll notice the text, it says, commanding his household to keep the ways of the Lord. Again, I want to emphasize that. That was no small task, and it would play an integral, I can never say that word, part in God's plan to save man, specifically God's plan for Abraham, the teaching of his household to walk in the ways of the Lord. That was no small matter. And so we emphasize that again, and as we noted last week, we see both the love and justice, not just of God, but of Abraham, on the great exchange, the negotiation, if you will, the prayerful bargaining over as they're considering Sodom's fate, and Lord, will indeed you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Of course, he would not. So then in chapter 19, of course, we have, I suppose I could put my slide from last week up here, we'll just leave that laying up there. We see the destruction of the cities of the valley, and it was more than, we noted more than just the two that we remember. There was also Adma and Gibeon, and then a city named Bela or Bela, perhaps better known as Zoar, also part of the story. I offered, not dogmatically, that God may have in fact destroyed that city had Lot not sought asylum there. But these were the same five city-states that were defeated in that great war back in chapter 14. And we noted those kings forgot the kindness that God had shown to them through Abram, as he was known at the time. They had become guilty of many sins. We talked about any number of those. You can read through the prophets. These cities are mentioned time and again. It wasn't just that they were crazed with sexual lust. They were a violent society. They were inhospitable. They were violent to strangers, certainly, as we see happening in the text here. And then we also see this. We didn't get to talk a lot about this, but had a number of conversations after. There are some aspects of this whole story that, boy, we don't understand everything about them, you know. Lot put himself in quite a bad position. Now, the final word on Lot in 2 Peter chapter 2, which we're going to read in a second, is that he was righteous. We should not dispute divine commentary on Lot. That is the last word on him. That's Holy Spirit speaking. I'm not going to quibble with that. Did he pay a steep price for building a life near and with the people he did? Absolutely. But 2 Peter chapter 2 is a good passage for us to consider as we ponder a couple of different scenes in the book of Genesis. 2 Peter chapter 2, this is, we'll just put this under the heading of lessons for us that we can take away from all of this. 2 Peter 2 and verse 4, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness." Seems fitting to read about this. We've just been studying all this. "With seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter. And if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men." We can see a big example of that in Genesis 19, can't we? And then parenthetically it says of Lot, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man. So a second time he's called righteous. So if we quibble with it once, what are we going to say when he's called righteous a second time? For by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. God knew exactly what Lot had to endure there. What's the conclusion? Why does Peter cite all those examples? Verse 9. Then, so it's if then. You pick up on the ifs. If this, if this, if this, then. Verse 9. "The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment." That's one of the big threads. That's the thread he's emphasizing here that runs through all those examples. God is a God of justice. God is a fair God. God knows how to rescue the righteous. God knows who the righteous are. God knows who the unrighteous are. And he will punish the unrighteous. God knows how to handle his business. And then verse 10, contextually with regard to these false teachers Peter's writing about, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and despise authority. Okay, and he goes on to talk about them some more. But that's the context in which Peter references these events, many of which, if not all, well, we don't know about the angels who sin necessarily. What book, if any, of the Bible is speaking about that? Anyway, so Lot paid a steep price. We could note a number of ways in which his decision to continue to move closer and closer to Sodom. Of course, in chapter 19, he finds himself at the city gate. So what manifold price did he pay? Well, we noted he was limited in his ability to show hospitality to strangers, right? Faced with impossible choices in protecting guests and protecting his family. We find that he was hesitant when urged to leave the city. So, we could chalk that up to Lot being perhaps a hopeless optimist. You know, maybe thinking, I can change these people. I can help these people. Maybe he was thinking about those sons-in-law who thought the angels were joking. You know, he knew they weren't coming with him. Lost his possessions, friends, livelihood, lost his wife who felt compelled for whatever reason to look back, lost his daughters who felt compelled to resort to sordid measures to preserve offspring. And so it provides, while yes, he was a righteous man, we could say made an unwise choice, a big one, provides a heartbreaking contrast to Abraham on his ability to lead his household to follow God. So think of that 18:19 charge that we spoke about. Abraham was to lead his household in following the ways of the Lord. Lot was not able to do that the way Abraham would be able to do that. And if the example of Sodom and Gomorrah, to Peter's point, serves as a warning, I dare say Lot's story likewise serves as a warning. That brings us to Genesis 20 and 21, where we'll pick up a couple of things here. We were introduced last time to the language of Hesed. The word that translators have a difficult time with, because it's just not a really good equivalent in our language, but it's the idea of God's covenant faithfulness expressed in his loving kindnesses, his mercy, his compassion. God remembered Abraham when he overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah and demonstrated his hesed in rescuing Lot. In chapter 20, we find that Abraham moves to Philistine territory and is going to interact with their king Abimelech. God will protect Sarah, because God by this point has promised what about Sarah? She will bear you, Abraham, a son. And so he protects Sarah from defilement, he protects the promise, and he protects Abimelech. There's the whole exchange between Abimelech and God, where clearly Abimelech shows he has respect for God. We'll note several godly characteristics that he demonstrates. But he's concerned about Abimelech. Abimelech cares about the sanctity of marriage. We see Abimelech showing concern for proper restitution. I mean, he goes above and beyond to make restitution, not just to Abraham, but to who else? To Sarah. He's concerned about her name being cleared before all people. He has an understanding of sin. He has a concern for being blameless in heart. He's generous to Abraham, concerned for Sarah's reputation, as I said. And so God shows care for him in the instructions he gives him, almost as a foretaste of the gospel. I mean, God wasn't kidding when he says, in your seed, God always had an eye on all nations and people of all nations, that he might bless them. And so it's stated and shown in these chapters, Abraham is indeed a prophet. God uses Abraham to bless Abimelech. In fact, in chapter 21 later, they'll make a covenant together. Well, then in chapter 21, a son is born to Abraham and Sarah according to promise. Abraham's age is again cited. It was cited when he was 99, and it's cited when he's 100. Again, I think to provide evidence to the reader that yes, God did exactly what he said he would do. A year from now, at about this time, she'll bear you a son. And so this is a really neat moment in the history of these two aged servants of God. Abraham and Sarah have both at different points laughed, I think, in their amazement at what God was proposing. A child? Really? It's one of those, just, you ever been so amazed or just so overcome with something, you just couldn't help but giggle a little bit. It was just, wow, right? I wouldn't be dogmatic about that, but and listen, God doesn't let that concept go of laughter. In fact, the naming of the child will reflect that. Isaac, I think, means laughter, because God has now brought laughter and joy and blessing to the heart of this aged couple. And from that point on, I hearken back to 18:19, because I think what we see now from this point on is Abraham and Sarah then beginning to take this charge to teach their household very, very seriously. They begin to act in ways that I think will be conducive to fulfilling that instruction to teach their household to walk in the ways of the Lord. We just have a series of statements in chapter 21. Abraham names the son Isaac per commandment. It's almost like Abraham does this, Abraham does this, Abraham does this. Well, he's establishing a pattern of behavior that his son will be able to learn from. And we'll see it in the very next chapter. Isaac's been trained very well. That's why I'm hearkening back to 18:19. He circumcises him at 8 days old, again per commandment. Celebrates, we're told, in 22, about verse 7 maybe. I have to get back there. 21, sorry, verse 8, 21:8. Abraham celebrates the day Isaac is weaned. Again, it's just another milestone, another marker in the journey, and Abraham is celebrating. He's filled with laughter and with joy. Then Sarah, this is a kind of an interesting sort of, how would we call it, full circle sort of moment. I think Sarah, not just out of spite, not just out of displeasure at Ishmael's mocking, we're not told exactly who or what he was mocking, except perhaps maybe he was mocking Isaac. I don't know. Maybe you have a translation that would shed a little more light on that. But I believe out of respect for God's promise that Isaac will be the one through whom their descendants will be called. Out of a desire to ensure, we know that this isn't a matter of conjecture, out of a desire to ensure Isaac's place as the rightful heir, per God's will, asks Abraham to send away Ishmael and his mother Hagar. Now, of course, who's responsible for Ishmael coming into existence? At least in part, Sarah. She put all of that into motion. Well, now the Lord is going to say, no, you, Abraham, you listen to her. She's right in that. And so they're going to be sent away. We see God's care for Hagar and for Ishmael. God's going to make of Ishmael a great nation. And we're not quite done with Ishmael, because who will it be that will convey a young man named Joseph to the land of Egypt? What group of people? Ishmaelites. Comment back here, Trish.
Just to go back about the firstborn, Ishmael, he was 14 years old when Isaac was born, and you know how catty young teens like that can be, and he probably could see that he was not being treated the way Isaac was.
Yeah.
I mean, they had parties every time he turned over. And here Ishmael was the literal firstborn.
Yeah.
And he was probably getting nothing, and I'm sure his mother contributed to that,
yeah,
reminding him all the time.
Sure.
So he would have been easy for him to tease about his other brother.
Yeah, it's easy for us to arrive at plausible explanations for it that the text doesn't really speak to. But yeah, I've had a few of those teenagers. I know exactly what you're talking about. Nothing against teenagers, by the way. Careful what you say about teenagers. We have some in the room tonight. But yeah, that's a good point. That the fact is, it wasn't a healthy mix. It wasn't a healthy situation. It just further illuminates, I think, God's design from the very beginning. Okay, so let's pivot now. And of course, I've spent twice as long as I intended on that. That's just the way I roll. And so now let's pivot and go to chapter 22. I just wanted to go back and touch on some of that. By the way, if there are points of that, I know, just if this, we operate on the iceberg principle, that just from the few things that some of you shared with me, that there are aspects of the text you really struggle with and you want to get together and talk about them. Absolutely. Would love to do that. If you'll buy the coffee, I'll show up. And yeah, you were intended to laugh there. I can buy my own coffee, but... Anyway, so Genesis 22, before we actually get into the text of 22, can we note back just two verses prior in chapter 21? After all of this, after the covenant with Abimelech, it says that Abraham plants a tree. It's a tamarisk tree. Yes, I had to look up what a tamarisk tree was, because other than it being a tree and it starting with the letter T, I knew nothing about it. But it has everything to do with what Abraham says about God in that place. It says that he worships God. Do you remember the expression used of God there? 21:33. He called on the name of the Lord. The everlasting God. Anybody have a different rendering besides everlasting God?
Eternal
God. It's that word for eternity, for everlasting, that really at its core is just a period of undetermined length, but it goes on for a long time. And not in every context does it mean eternal. It obviously does here with reference to God. I went the wrong way, didn't I? So in 2133, that seemed like a good phrase to carry with us through these chapters. A tamarisk tree. Here's what I found about tamarisk tree. The Hebrew word eshel refers to a type of tree, specifically the tamarisk tree, in the context of the Bible, often associated with hospitality and provision. The tamarisk is a long-living tree that can thrive in arid conditions, symbolizing endurance and sustenance. Boy, just that just fits Abraham's and Sarah's story. I mean, how long has God sustained them? Abraham reaches triple digits before his son of promise is born, and I think there's a 10-year... Sarah's 90 when Abraham is 100. Well, after these things, chapter 22 and verse 1, we're going to find Isaac is an older boy, demonstrates a good understanding of sacrifice and worship, I think a further testament to what we've been advancing, that they've taken their charge seriously to teach their household to walk in the ways of the Lord. Isaac is described, notice the wording here, I'm going to trust that almost all of us, if not all of us, are familiar with the story of the offering of Isaac. Here's what God says in Genesis 22 and verse 2. He said, "Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you." There's a little bit of the same kind of language there that we see all the way back in chapter 12. I want you to leave and go out. And he kind of uses the same language, to the land which I will show you. He's not telling him specifically which mountain yet. He's asking him to go forward in faith. And of course, he's going to. He did that at 75. He does it now. He's well over 100 by this point. Notice how Isaac is described. Preachers love when there are 3 points in a text. Here's point number one. Isaac's called your son. And just that expression where Abraham's concerned just evokes all kinds of wonderful things. Lots of ups and downs, lots of heartbreaks, and now in these last few years, lots of joy. Your son. There was a time where Abraham laughed at the prospect of that. And yet now here's this boy. Maybe he was about y'all's age. I don't know. Here he is. Your son. Those were not just words that he... I promise you, Abraham didn't take those two words for granted. Your son. Then, so that speaks of God's faithfulness, doesn't it? Then second point, your only son. I think he's pointing here to something different. When he says, your only son, what's meant by that? Because we, us literalists, we think, oh, well, no, wait a second. Isaac's not your only son. In what sense is this true?
Son of promise.
Son of promise. Son of promise. So there is an exclusivity to this. Scott, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to think, when the scriptures in the New Testament talk about Jesus as the only begotten Son, what it literally means is that he's, you know, God's one and only Son. I mean, he's the Son of promise, I mean, like you said. So right. I think this, when it says your only Son, sort of foreshadows into the fact
yes,
of what God's going to do.
Exactly right. This is definitely there in the section of your lesson where it says glimpses of Jesus. There should be more ink than white showing on your workbook. I'm only kidding a little bit. Your son, your only son, and then the expression, whom you love. Now that's a phrase that resonates throughout the room. We've spoken of the blessing of laughter and joy and delight that they have only just now begun to experience in these last few years. Some of you know the laughter and joy and delight of grandchildren. And I'll say this publicly, I've heard that's the coolest invention ever. I never have to ask twice to have someone tell me about their grandkids. But that's a thought that resonates through the room. Your only son, and we would apply this thought to daughters too, we're not leaving them out, whom you love. So we have God's faithfulness, the exclusivity of his promise, and the blessings that he has provided. Again, think of that tamarisk tree. God has been with them all this time. Nothing will test the heart like the intense emotions of parenthood. I would posit God knows precisely what he's asking Abraham to do. How long did Abraham get to ponder this big ask from God?
3 days.
How long were those 3 days? Yeah, that's a silly question, isn't it? Probably felt like 3 years. How long did God, I know he's eternal, but from the beginning, he purposed that his son would die on a cross. So if we're thinking, well, how long did he have to think about this, knowing ahead of time what was coming? When God gives this instruction to Abraham, he knows that's coming. I just can't even. We think, oh, well, he's God. It didn't bother him at all. Think again. Think again. He knows what will come later. Go forth to the land of which I will tell you, the land of Moriah. Same area, of course, where Jerusalem was located. Some have tried to deposit that, you know, the exact place where Isaac was crucified would be the exact spot of the Temple Mount, and that may be so, but There's not a clear correlation between Moriah and, because Jesus was crucified outside the city, don't forget. But certainly in the same general area. But the parallels here, I mean, Scott, to your point, are perfectly clear. So Abraham's commanded, and then we see Abraham responding by faith. He gets ready. He goes to the place that God tells him. Verse 5, confident of their return. I think that is a faith statement in verse 5. We will worship and we will return to you. And the reason why I conclude that is because of the weight of the commentary in Hebrews 11, where we're told that Abraham believed something about God. What was it? What was he able to do? Yeah, able to bring Isaac back to life. So we're not necessarily made privy to that in Genesis, but later on we are. And so I take verse 5 here as a faith statement and a very beautiful statement. Do I pray with that kind of faith? And then, of course, the third day after Isaac is essentially given over to God, at least in Abraham's heart, when he's sentenced to death, as it were, Abraham receives Isaac back. He's not slain. He receives him back as a type. Isaac, here's another parallel. What does Isaac, what does Abraham place on Isaac? Oh, we have a comment. Go ahead. Sorry. I'm just up here rambling. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to point out one thing in verse 5 that you were mentioning is the fact that Abraham told the men that was with him that we will go and worship and come. We will come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
So Abraham's faith was fully developed here.
Yep.
I mean, we've seen him, by reading through Genesis, we've seen his faith waver at times, and you know, his lying, and going along with the having the son by Sarah's handmaid. But here we see where Abraham has fully developed his faith.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That "we" carries all the way through that verse. I and the lad, we will go over there. I and the lad, we will worship. And I and the lad, we will return to you. Good. Isaac is, upon him is placed the wood to be used for the sacrifice. Not quite like a cross, but on some level, a parallel you could argue nonetheless. Of course, one of the big parallels is what is Isaac told that God will provide? The lamb for the sacrifice. And so Abraham, you could say on some level, does offer Isaac on the altar. I mean, to the point where he reaches out his hand. Sometimes it's depicted like he's like this. I don't know that the text quite goes that far. Whatever. However you paint that picture, that's fine. But he reaches forth and takes the knife in his hand. So in his heart, he has given, he has not. The language God uses with him is, it shows a intimate knowledge of Abraham's heart. He has not withheld his son, as evidenced by his actions. He has walked by faith in a way that, God forbid, any of us might ever have to do. But maybe God not forbid. Maybe God will ask us to pay a fierce price for our faith. But he offers Isaac on the altar. He does not withhold Isaac from God. He offers him at least in his heart. And God goes on to bless him. Yeah, go ahead, sister. Let's get a mic up here so they can hear you. It's a necessary evil. Now we're thankful. Thank you, Aaron. Go ahead.
Thank you. I was just reading, and I think the end of verse 6 is so beautiful because it says, and the two of them walked together.
Yeah.
And Isaac was in full agreement with what his father was going to do. Mm.
He's been trained well. We would never want to add or take away, add to the text or take away from it. I don't read of any. Isaac is submissive in all of this. He's quite a young man. He's with his father. So the angel of the Lord speaks to Abraham, of course, serving as the mouthpiece of God. We see a similar language used of God. The Lord will provide. That's in verse 14. That, by the way, is the same language as the Lord who sees, all the way back in Genesis 16. Who says it there? The Lord, you are a God who sees. Hagar. The Egyptian maiden. Wonder if there was conversation about what Hagar encountered and experienced. I have to think there was. I can't prove that, obviously. When she came back and there was some discussion. That's before she sent away. The Lord, and so Abraham's using that same language here. God's going to reaffirm the promises to him. And he received news about the offspring of his brother Nahor, which of course introduces us to Bethuel, who is the father of Rebekah, who of course becomes the wife of Isaac. Chapter 23, we'll just note quickly, speaks of the death, and more time is given to the burial of Sarah. I think there is something here to be to noted about the honor that is shown to loved ones in death. I think that's all part and parcel of leading a household in the ways of the Lord. How do we lead our households, dads, in times of grief? Abraham's leading his household. he secures the, there's this long story here of, you know, securing this burial site for his family. But it's interesting that this site will be referenced time and again throughout the rest of the book of Genesis. It's an important place in the Genesis story. It's an important event in Abraham's story. Abraham secures this burial site from a person named Ephron the Hittite for Sarah, and it will become the burial spot for Isaac and for Rebecca. There's a cave in this field that he purchases that's known as the Cave of Machpelah, which faces Mamre or Hebron, however you say that. So what was significant about Hebron? For a long time, that's where Abraham pitched his tent. He's going to move around and has moved around since then. But Sarah's buried in this cave that's in that field. So that's what chapter 23 is about. So then we come to chapter 24. Of course, we'll just sum this up, but this is a great account of the selection of a bride for Isaac. And make no mistake about it, God is involved in the choosing. Again, who's leading his family in the ways of the Lord? Even after Sarah is gone, it's Abraham. Notice the care given in instructing the servant. Notice, which servant does he pick? The oldest in his household is what the text says. Why? Well, you don't entrust a job like this to just anyone. Is there a principle in that for us? I should hope so. Who are we entrusting with matters pertaining to our kids? How long do you think we could go on about that? That's challenging, isn't it? All of this falls under the umbrella of leading a household in the ways of the Lord. Abraham's now described as old, advanced in age, and yet still living with purpose. Secures a bride for his son Isaac in the selection of the servant, and boy, does that choice pan out. This servant demonstrates to be a man of real quality. He's a patient man. He's a prayerful man. You want to talk about putting out a Gideon fleece. And do you notice? Look at the elements of this prayer as you go through this in chapter 24. I don't have the verses here. Go find this. This is beautiful. Here are some of the things that you'll find in that prayer. This sentiment, grant me success today. There's a time element in that. There's a right now to that. Do I pray that way? I've got this meeting, this work meeting coming up. Before you go in there, Lord, grant me success today. That's a prayer that can be on our lips. Here's something else. He asks God to show his hesed, his loving kindness to his master Abraham. He puts out a fleece before the Lord, a specific way. Is that two first bells or a first followed immediately by a second? Okay, inquiring minds want to know. He puts out, I think, a fleece before the Lord, a way to know the answer. I'm looking for a specific, Lord, make it be the young lady who, and then he gives some criteria. Well, he gets some of the criteria, but then it says the man is just watching her in silence, waiting to see. He doesn't jump at the hat. He doesn't jump to conclusions. He's patient to wait on the Lord. Well, I've got part of the answer here. He's going to wait for the rest of it. Because after all, he's asked God for something. He honors his sovereignty in allowing him to answer as he wills on his timeline. And once he realizes that, yes, this is the girl, then, of course, there's rejoicing, there's lavishing gifts on her. And so there are all of it. There's some elements of great prayer. Question, where does this servant learn all of this? I dare say from his master who has been charged. Oh, where was that? Chapter 18, verse 19. to train his household in the ways of the Lord. And so they meet Rebecca. She's a girl of quality. There's a lengthy exchange with Bethuel and Laban where he shares the whole story. They clearly understand this is from God. There's some hesitancy the day when the servant gets up, wants to head back home. They kind of want to, let's figure out a way where you know, it's not like, well, you know, I'll see you in a couple of days. I'll just hop in my Honda Accord and drive over yonder. No. They may never see her again. But they end up departing for home. Rebecca's willing to go with them. And, of course, there's the beautiful, comforting passage where Isaac in his grief is comforted at meeting his bride-to-be. Chapter 25, Abraham's last days. Marries a woman named Keturah. He blesses Isaac as the heir. Dies at 175, the text says, in a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life. Isaac and Ishmael bury Abraham, yes, in the cave with Sarah. And so we have finished one of the more lengthy toledoths of Genesis. It ends here, not in accordance with our chapter divisions. A new toledoth begins in verse 12. These are the generations of Ishmael. So we'll get that for a few verses. Need a mic up here right quick. Actually, we need a mic back there and a mic up here. And since I don't know who raised their hand first, I'm going ladies first, all right? I don't think Scott will argue with that. Go ahead, Cynthia.
The comment about the servant following the direction of his master. Chapter 24, verse 48, "And I bowed my head and worshiped the Lord and blessed the Lord God of my master Abraham, who had led me in the way of truth to take the daughter of my master's brother for his son."
What verse is that?
Verse 48.
Okay, of 25. No, 24.
24,
48, sorry. Yeah, that's really good. "I bowed low in worship, blessed the Lord." So there's, how do I thank God for answers to prayer? What if they're not answers I wanted? Thank him anyway. And yeah, bowing low in worship is not a bad thing. Go ahead, Scott. I don't want to forget about you.
I'm just reflecting again on when Abraham was commanded to offer Isaac and that whole story. And I think after it was all over, I wonder, did Abraham and Isaac sit around and think about, you know, what was God doing or meaning or what was he showing? Because God, as we can tell from the scripture, doesn't do things without a purpose. And so, you know, I don't know if he was thinking about, well, it's through my seed that all the nations are to be blessed. If he was thinking about that, probably didn't understand it. Mm-mm. And how fortunate we are to live on this side of the cross to really see all of it. But I think about the words of our master Jesus, who said in Matthew 13:17, "For I truly, I say to you, many prophets and righteous people long to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it." I mean, everybody in the Old Testament didn't really get it fully or couldn't get it until Jesus actually came.
Right.
And so just, I mean, what an incredible story. And
absolutely.
And how, you know, just shows the working of God throughout all of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And what lessons we learn about faith and the faith of a person like Abraham. We touched on all of these along the way tonight, but perhaps as they flash back up here, these are all lessons Israel certainly could learn. And of course, we have some glimpses of Jesus. So anyway, I think I heard the second tone earlier, but the sound says they're coming. Stampede. Thank you all.